Muchas gracias, Betty. Buenos días, hermanos y hermanas. Hoy es un día muy lindo y estados están muy simpáticas. I am going to begin this morning with some explanatory remarks. I work from a set text, and that is for the convenience of the translator. But I am going to be a little bit naughty this morning. I am going to depart from the set text from time to time. Most will be in little ways. But there is one point when I will be speaking spontaneously for some minutes. When I do that, I will speak in short sentences, and I will make pauses between them. This is for the convenience of the translator. Now, the title of my remarks this morning is Our Mission as Theosophists. And that was given to me by Terezinha. But it is a good subject at any time. Return to text. Madame Blavatsky memorably said, "Theosophist is who theosophy does." Her emphasis on action rather than on belief or opinion is echoed in the three objects of the Theosophical Society, which H.S. Alcott originally composed. The verbs of our three objects, as we have them today, are to form, to encourage, and to investigate. Those are all verbs of action. Theosophy is not a matter of believing, but of doing. However, every doing also involves a way of viewing. So the actions stated in our objects are linked with the three fundamental propositions of the secret doctrine. Practice and theory, doing and viewing are not opposites, but complements. Departure. The word theory, or teoria, in both English and Spanish, comes ultimately from Greek. And the Greek word from which theory comes means to view, to look at. So a theory is just a way of looking at things. And if we're going to do anything, we have to look at what we're doing. So theory and practice go together, doing and viewing. Let us consider some implications of doing theosophy according to the society's objects, but also in the light of viewing theosophy through the fundamental propositions. My remarks now will be in four parts. Part one. Our first object is to form a nucleus of the universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, caste, or color. In that object, two little words are very important. They are the two parts of speech that grammarians call articles. They are the little words a and the. Although all of our objects have undergone some modification and rewording over the years, those particular two little words, the indefinite article a and the definite article the, are very significant, and I believe they were chosen after careful deliberation. First, consider the article the in the phrase, the universal brotherhood of humanity. We do not create brotherhood. Brotherhood is a fact in nature. There is only one such universal brotherhood. There is no other such grouping. So it is the universal brotherhood of humanity. The word the means that the brotherhood we are talking about is uniquely identified, and there is only one. All human beings are fundamentally and basically the same in their genetic inheritance. Bodily differences that may seem very great to us are really trivial and superficial. We are clearly one species with only minor variations in types. Indeed, we are one of the most genetically unified species on the planet. Similarly, we are psychologically basically the same. We all feel the same emotions. We all think the same thoughts. We all respond alike. A little departure. William Shakespeare, the great English playwright, has a play called The Merchant of Venice, which is about a Jew who has been severely discriminated against. His name is Shylock. Return to text. As Shylock asks in Shakespeare's play, The Merchant of Venice, if you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? So the first object does not commit us to forming human brotherhood. That brotherhood already exists. It is a fact of life. The first object commits us instead to forming a nucleus of that brotherhood. Now consider the word a in that expression. The word a indicates one out of others. We are not the only nucleus of brotherhood. We are only one among several. perhaps one among many. So it is a nucleus, our one particular nucleus. What makes our nucleus different from others? Well, one possibility is that our nucleus is not limited to a single lifetime. In the early 20th century, theosophists talked about a band of servers. That band consists of souls who have dedicated themselves not for one life only, but for all lives, to serve the ideals of the ancient wisdom and the cause of the masters of that wisdom. The Theosophical Society serves, as it were, as a gathering place to bring together members of that band as they reincarnate in our time, coming together anew, as they have been together in past lives, serving the same ideals and the same cause. The Society also introduces new members into the band, which is the nucleus the first object is talking about. Now a long digression, or interjection. I think that often we misunderstand what it means to be a member of the band or the nucleus. We misunderstand how members of that nucleus should behave toward one another. Will it surprise you if I say that theosophists do not always agree with one another? It is all right to disagree, but we must disagree in a brotherly way. And in fact, brotherly disagreement is very important. In the West, human societies have organized a system for disagreeing. In colleges and universities and schools, they have debate teams, groups that disagree with one another on a subject. And notice that in a typical debate, it doesn't matter whether you believe in the side you are arguing for or not. The important thing is that you defend a point and that you do so in the right way. Moreover, organized disagreement is not limited to schools. It is the basis of our parliaments and congresses, our governmental functions. So organized disagreement is a characteristic of Western life. On the other hand, enforced agreement is tyranny. Only in undemocratic and tyrannic nations is everyone expected to think alike. Now, this respect for harmonious disagreement is the essence of brotherhood. And although it has been organized in the West, it is also known in the East. There is a famous parable in the Confucian tradition about this. I have written about that parable several times before, but I'm going to tell it to you this morning briefly. Once there was a ruler in China who was very great. A Confucian scholar came to see him. And the ruler complained to the Confucian scholar. The ruler said, "Oh, I have such bad ministers. Of all my ministers, there is only one who is harmonious with me. And the Confucian scholar said, "What do you mean? That one minister whom you are talking about is not harmonious. He merely agrees with everything you say." And the ruler replied, What? Harmony and agreement, they're the same thing." And the Confucian scholar replied, No. Harmony and agreement are quite different things." "Harmony," said the Confucian scholar, "is like making a bowl of soup. You start with a pot of water. To the water, you add various ingredients, vegetables, spices, herbs. And as you make the soup, you taste it. If it is too bland, you add more spices. If it is too tangy, you add more water. And so you add spices and waters, you strengthen and you weaken the mixture until it is exactly right. And then you have a perfect pot of soup. You do not make soup," said the Confucian scholar, "by adding water to water. Your minister, when he agrees with you, is simply adding water to water." End of parable. That is a very wise story. Agreement and harmony are not the same thing. We can disagree harmoniously. And in fact, harmonious disagreement is the basis for arriving at a pot of perfect soup and a community of perfect people. Out of harmonious disagreement come the very best decisions. So let us disagree. But let us disagree harmoniously. Let us make a pot of perfect soup. Return to set text. Thus, according to the first object, we as theosophists are one nuclear family within the wider human family. We are an inner family that welcomes anyone from the outer family who wishes to join us and who is in sympathy with the objects of the society. part two. Our second object is to encourage the study, comparatively, of religion, philosophy, and science. Again, the words of this object are very important. The object does not commit us to the actual study of religion, philosophy, and science. What is the operative verb in that object? Not to study, but to encourage. Some of us actually study religion, philosophy, and science. Some of us do not. Whether we engage in such study personally is purely a matter of personal choice. What the object does commit us to is to encourage such study. But how do we encourage study? Well, again, for individuals, that is highly personal. But collectively, as a society, we sponsor lectures and discussions. We come together in groups like this and listen politely to one another's views. We support the publication of books and periodicals, and we acknowledge that such study has value. In addition, the study we are encouraging is not just academic acquisition of information about religion, philosophy, and science. Instead, it has a comparative focus. And that comparison can be of two kinds. First, all human learning, all human knowledge, including religion, philosophy, and science, varies very greatly from one culture to another. You're aware of that, aren't you? How varied those things are among human cultures. Such variation is most obvious in the area of religion. But philosophy and even science vary culturally as well. Cultural differences in religion, philosophy, and science often serve as walls to block human communication. We think that our religion, philosophy, or science is the only truth about the world. To overcome such blockage or such ethnocentrism, such exclusive concentration on our own culture, we need to understand its cause. And therefore, we need to compare the religion, philosophy, and science of our culture with those of other cultures. The only way we can become free of the blinders that cultural ignorance places upon our mental eyes is that. That is the only way we can realize that between the cultural differences that divide us, we all share a common humanity, which is greater and more important than any of our cultures. Now, the second kind of comparative focus looks at how religion, philosophy, and science differ from one another in their aims, in their purposes. Science basically aims at an understanding of the physical world around us. Philosophy basically aims at an understanding of the mental processes going on inside us, including the logic we use and the assumptions we make. Religion basically aims at an understanding of our relationship to a reality outside of both our personal selves and our physical environment. It is concerned with ultimate values. Those three modes of understanding should not conflict with one another because their aims are different. Outward for science, inward for philosophy, and upward, so to speak, for religion. However, people who practice the three modes do often disagree with one another. Particularly, Western religionists and scientists are often in conflict. So our second object includes an encouragement for comparative study of the three modes of understanding with the aid of reconciling them. According to the second object, we should realize how our ways, our modes of understanding life relate to one another, and how different cultures form and shape the way we understand life. Part three. Our third object is to investigate unexplained laws of nature and the powers latent in human beings. Now, that object does not commit us to personal research into those matters. We are not expected all to become parapsychologists or to work at developing our psychic faculties. Indeed, we are warned against psychic development, because psychic abilities are best left to evolve naturally and not to be forced. The operative verb in the third object is to investigate. The word investigate comes from a Latin word which means literally to pay attention to footprints, to follow tracks. The Latin word which underlies investigate is vestigium, and that means a footprint. So what the third object does encourage us today to do is to pay attention to the signs that there are unexplained laws of nature and powers latent within us. We are expected to track the footprints. In another play by Shakespeare, Hamlet, Hamlet told his friend Horatio, "There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of or than science realizes." And that's what the third object is about. In the late 1800s, some scientists thought that all the basic laws of physics had been discovered, and all that was necessary was to clear up a few pesky little details. Today, scientists are aware of the vast realm of the unexplained and mysterious in nature. Indeed, much of what scientific theorists postulate today seems downright bizarre and fantastic. It makes the secret doctrine seem to be a very ordinary book. Some scientists now postulate the existence of 11 dimensions in the universe. And others more recently have argued that time does not exist at all. It is merely an illusion. As we have learned more about the world, we have come to realize how little we actually know, and what a wonderfully strange place the world is. The wonderful thing about education is that the more we know, the more we realize how little we know. Serious research into those unexplained and mysterious matters is for experts, not amateurs, who can only track the footprints of the experts in such exploration. However, all of us do have certain latent powers that we can and should develop. Those latent powers are not psychic faculties like clairvoyance. They are instead the powers of love and sympathy, of understanding and insight. Those are latent powers whose activation is both safe and beneficial for all of us. We can develop those latent powers in various ways, especially by the practice of meditation, which is a process of stilling or distracting our busy outer minds so that our inner awareness or intuition can shine through and enlighten us. Meditating is putting the third object into practice. And meditation is of many various kinds. We may think of it as just sitting quietly and stilling our thoughts. Well, to be sure, that is meditation. But it is much like what ballet dancers do when they exercise at a handrail, right? Or what a pianist does when he or she practices the scales on a piano. Such practice is necessary. But the ideal of meditation is a state of mind, a keen awareness that persists during whatever activity we are doing. All forms of meditation, including ritual, which is meditation in motion, are aimed at creating that persistent state of mind, calm, alert, aware, insightful. According to the third object, we should track efforts to explain the unexplained, and we may activate our own latent powers of understanding and sympathy. Part four. Now, how does our doing theosophy in these three ways, the three ways of the three objects, how does that correlate with our viewing theosophy as a way of looking at the universe and ourselves? A classic statement of theosophical views is that of the secret doctrine's fundamental propositions. So let us briefly explore the interconnections between the doing and the viewing. The nucleus of universal brotherhood, which our first object calls upon us to form, reflects the secret doctrine's first fundamental proposition. That proposition asserts the existence of, quote, an omnipresent, eternal, boundless, and immutable principle which is beyond the range and reach of thought, end quote. That principle is the one great inner reality that underlies all the many diverse little realities of the outer world. Ultimately, there is only one existence, one life, one reality. And we are parts of, or expressions of, that one. The nucleus we form is a recognition that all existence, from the grains of sand at our feet to the farthest galaxies of the cosmos, is the manifestation of that single underlying reality. So all human beings are members of a single universal brotherhood within which we are forming a particular nuclear group. Ultimately, every being in the universe has the same essence as every other being in the universe. All is one. That concept gives coherence to our nucleus. The comparative study, which the second object calls upon us to encourage, reflects the secret doctrine's second fundamental proposition. That proposition asserts the existence of, quote, a law of periodicity, of flux and reflux, ebb and flow in all departments of nature, end quote. All branches of human learning, including religion, philosophy, and science, are attempts to make sense out of and to adjust our behavior to the changes we experience in life as a result of that law of periodicity. Nothing stays the same in life, right? The Buddha told us that. All things are changing. To understand the changes, we must study the world around us, ourselves, and how we are linked to the great ultimate. All of those periodical changes affect us spiritually, intellectually, and physically. We encourage the comparative study of religion, philosophy, and science, indeed of all branches of human learning, not out of any abstract admiration for knowledge, but rather because such comparison has survival value for us in the physical, intellectual, and spiritual realms. Ultimately, we must come to understand one another. And to do so, we must understand our cultural differences and the diversity of the ways we are trying to understand life. The unexplained laws of nature and the powers latent within ourselves, which the third object calls upon us to investigate, remember to track. That reflects the secret doctrine's third fundamental proposition. That proposition asserts, quote, the fundamental identity of all souls with the universal oversoul and the obligatory pilgrimage for every soul through the cycle of incarnation, end quote. The landscape in which we make our pilgrimage is the universe, whose laws we must come to understand. One cannot travel through a country, a land, one which one does not understand. And our pilgrimage is achieved only when we have activated our latent spiritual powers. When we have tracked all the laws of nature and have come to understand their explanation, when we have activated all of our latent spiritual abilities, then and then only will we have arrived at the goal of our pilgrimage. Then the cycle of incarnation will be closed. Then we will have realized our identity with the universal oversoul. Then we will have returned home to the Great Mother. Our mission as theosophists is simple, but challenging. It is to do theosophy. And we do theosophy by putting the society's three objects into practice. That practice involves forming a nucleus, encouraging comparative study of cultures, and investigating the unexplained and the latent. But to do theosophy, we need also to view theosophy by understanding the basics of the theosophical worldview. That understanding should recognize three things. First, the underlying oneness of reality. Second, the cyclical nature of all manifested existence. And three, the goal of realizing our individual identity with the ground of all being, and thus with one another. doing theosophy and viewing theosophy are interconnected. May we view it with clarity and do it with earnestness. May our pilgrimage be joyous. And may we all arrive at the one goal together.